Okay. We'll start in a few moments. The next project, so you can start getting ready, will be the IR communications for the electronic bandage. You guys here?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So you'll be next after these guys. Okay.
Give them a verbal reminder on next week.
Yes. I sent out an email. There is a reminder that there is a sign-up sheet on my office door for your sit-down debriefings and project reviews next week. The instructions for it are on the web page. That is, the instructions for what's going to go on at the design review are on the web page. We're going to take down the sign-up sheets at 9 a.m. Friday morning. So sign up before then, so that we can figure out our schedules for next week to be at your meetings. So half of you have signed up, half of you have not. You've got about a little bit under 48 hours. So that's plenty of time. Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started with the first of today's presentations and take it away.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ashish Desai, and this is Michael Weiss, my partner. The title of our project is Discovery of Organizing Principles of the JAK-STAT Signaling Pathway through the Design of In Silico Experiments. And our technical advisors are both here, actually, Professor Srinath and his PhD student, Regina Sobianto. Now, what we've decided to focus our project on is the biochemical behavior of a cell, and we're specifically relating this to cancer and leukemia. So, to give a little background on what a signaling pathway actually is, it's essentially a network of biochemical reactions that in a cell which are triggered by an external stimuli. And this, usually these pathways, they determine the functionality of a cell. They'll tell the cell whether to divide, grow, or even die. So we have decided to focus our efforts on what is called the JAK-STAT signaling pathway. This pathway, the reason why we've chosen it is because it's been implicated in cancer, specifically leukemia, and it also promotes stem cell self-renewal. Now, this is what we call a cartoon of the pathway. The reason why it's called a cartoon, it doesn't actually look like this in the body. This is a way for humans to kind of comprehend what's going on. And this is essentially the set of biochemical reactions. So what happens, to give a little background, is when a protein binds to the surface of a cell, it'll trigger a cascade of biochemical reactions. And when these pass through the nuclear membrane, I'm not sure if you can read it. This is the nuclear membrane. When they pass through the nuclear membrane into the nucleus, they'll come and they'll target a particular gene. And what they'll do is it'll make the gene express. And when the gene expresses, it has various effects on the cell. It can promote, for example, tumor growth, and so it causes various behaviors. And something interesting to this, especially for systems engineers, is oftentimes when the gene expresses and creates another protein, let's say, that protein may actually have an effect on the signaling pathway. And what we call that feedback. So that's essentially what we are looking at. We're looking at these biochemical reactions, and each chemical reaction can be converted into a nonlinear ordinary differential equation. So what we're going to be studying this using what's called the systems biology paradigm. What that is traditionally, the way biologists work is they sit around, they come up with some kind of hypothesis. They take this hypothesis and based on it, they design some experiments. And based on those experiments, they get their data, they come back and they sit around with each other and they kind of determine what does this data mean. It may not mean anything, it may mean something. And based on that, they'll either revise their hypothesis or they'll confirm it. Where we come in is after this data has been generated, we'll take it and we will come up with a mathematical model of the system that we're talking about. So we'll create the model, and we can therefore run simulations in, for example, MATLAB, or there's other programs we can use for that. Based on our simulations, we can give feedback back to the biologists on maybe a particular part of the pathway or something that they should focus on. Now, the advantage of our simulation versus, not the advantage, but something that's good about actually simulating on a computer is that these experiments that the biologists run, they may take up from 6 to 8 weeks depending on from initial setup to final analysis of the data, because they have to get certain chemicals, they have to treat certain the cell lines, and they have to do all these certain things. Our simulations, once our model has been made, can take 2 seconds. So that's where we come in. And what we'll do is we'll work with the biologists
to give feedback to each other and go forth from there. Now, the objectives of our particular project are, first of all, we'd like a calibrated and validated mathematical model that represents biological reality as it relates to the JAK-STAT signaling pathway. Our other objective is to actually understand the behavior and the organizing principles of the pathway using the systems biology approach that I talked about. As for our progress, we have come up with a model. An initial mathematical model has been created. And actually, beyond that, the simulator has been created. So we've actually simulated a model based on some data that we got, the biochemical reactions that we got from a paper by Yamada in 2003. Now, this model, it's been calibrated and it's been validated, actually. So now what we look to do is, since it's been calibrated and validated for a certain cell line, what we look to do is take the data that we're going to get from our collaborators that we're working with at the Cleveland Clinic, and we look to take that data and fit our currently calibrated model to the new data that we'll receive. So calibrated and validated to the new data. A little background on how the model is created. You can use general mass action law to convert these biochemical reactions into differential equations. So if you see, if you have a reaction A plus B goes into AB, and you have a forward reaction constant of KF and a backward reaction constant of KB, you can essentially come up with differential equations for A, B, and AB. And I won't get into how exactly to do that. Additionally, for our progress, we've also received initial data from our Cleveland Clinic collaborators. And our analysis, we have completed an analysis on the data, and what we've realized is that when they create the data, they get relative data on the concentrations of the components of the pathway. What we need to actually run a model is absolute data. So this created a little bit of a problem, but we relayed that feedback back to them. They're working currently on getting absolute data for us. But like I said, these experiments take a long time. So instead of sitting around, what we've decided to do is conduct parametric sensitivity analysis. This was our backup plan in case something like this happened. So what this means is we're going to essentially look through the parameters and find relevant ranges for each parameter value using literature and using other techniques that we can use to find relevant ranges of parameters. Then we can either confirm those with the data when we get them from that or use that to actually simulate our model. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about our management.
Okay. As Ashish mentioned, we're pretty much on track going by this chart here. We're just about to start the parametric sensitivity analysis. In the event that we do get data back, that'll give us a kind of an estimate to compare it to. If we don't, we can just use that as kind of a relatively accurate model. When that's over, then we're going to calibrate the model to either the data set or the parameters that we estimate and do what we call parametric studies. Which is where we vary the parameters over different ranges to kind of determine the behavior of the system. We look for instances of bias stability or coordination or certain things like that. And, I think that's it.
Any questions?
I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding what you've done and what remains yet to be done here from your presentation.
Okay. Yeah, what do the blues and the whites mean?
Yeah.
Well, the whites are just the more administrative things, like the reports and the presentations. Mm-hmm. As you can see, we've evaluated the appropriateness. We have a calibrated model from the literature that we're using. We've gotten the initial data set we looked at, and as Ashish mentioned, we discovered that it's relative and we need absolute data, so we communicated that to the Cleveland Foundation team. And so right now, we're pretty much where that red line is, where we're both waiting for the new data and also about to begin the parametric sensitivity analysis.
Okay, so everything to the left of that has been done.
Yeah.
Okay. So you need to show conclusions explicitly, like maybe a different color or something.
Okay.
That's right.
You also probably need to identify who's doing each task, or are you both doing every one of them?
Since it's just a two-person team, we're thinking that we're all doing both of them, actually.
Okay.
Well, we have a group leader. I'm the group leader for now, but in terms of actual work on the project, each task we're doing it together.
Okay.
So if you've got a little bit of a change now, you're using a plan now that brought a task in that you originally didn't plan.
No, we planned for this task. See, as you can see, like we have these two tasks going parallel with each other.
Yeah.
The waiting for data from the team and also performing the parametric sensitivity analysis.
Okay.
That was kind of, this was our safety in case we didn't get data that we could actually use.
So you intended to do that anyway?
We intended to do that in need,
yeah,
if we had to.
Alright.
Yeah. Okay. That's why they're running parallel.
The parametric analysis would have been probably done next semester, had they got the biological data.
Okay. And someone else will talk to you about next semester's project plan. It won't be me. Okay. Any questions? Come on. No one else? Usually we have a lot more questions.
Okay. You want to understand?
Yes.
What's the input to your model?
The input is IFN, interferon, say protein. You can see, you can't really see it, I'm clear, but it's IFN.
Okay. One question I have is, how do you know when you're done with the project, or, you know, what are your benchmarks? Is it simply that the biologists at the Cleveland Clinic are happy with the
No, there's a couple ways to benchmark what we've done. There's literature out there on this specific pathway because it's a pathway of interest. So there's ways to, that's one of the ways we've calibrated the model in the past, is comparing results that we get from our model to results that they've published.
So you actually have identified results that you want your model to match.
Yeah.
And that's going to be your benchmark.
Yeah, but see, the key is that we're now calibrating it to a new cell line, so we want to see if the results are similar along different cell lines.
Okay.
The group that we're working with was the one which discovered this pathway. Okay, so that's Jack Chat. So this is, it's a privilege to work with them. And they have had about 15 years of data, which is evolved to a level that you can start mathematics.
Okay. Good. Okay. Band-Aid people. And Norman, you make your form and ritual.
Yeah.
Okay, 19. Let's see who that is. Oh, that's a co-op. A lot of my numbers are co-op. Yeah, that's a co-op. I think that was you. I hope we didn't put the
energy
number back in.
Yeah.
18. Cryogenic motor. Okay. So you'll be after this one. Oh, I almost forgot. When you're up, if you would just simply copy your presentation over to the hard drive there, I'll get copies of all of them afterwards. Yeah.
Oh, so
whenever you guys are ready, go ahead. And we've got my laser pointer.
Did I steal it? No, it's still there.
Okay, just there's a pointer there if you want to use it. Just don't stick it in your eye.
All right, we're working on the electronic stimulator bandage research project with Dan Howe, who's a graduate student, and our advisor is Steve Garbrick. And our portion of the research project is the we're making PDA software to software for the PDA to allow a user to change the settings on the bandage and to read data from the bandage. So a little bit of background is this bandage uses electric stimulation to help heal pressure sores on patients. So and in order to get data from that, you need some sort of software to read the data from it. And we sort of divided this project into two parts: the communication protocol, which is sort of the language we use to talk to the bandage through the PDA, and we're doing that over an infrared link. And
the reason to do it over an infrared link is so you can get close to the bandage without actually touching it. Because if it the bandage is on a wound, you don't want to jostle the bandage, because that could lead to harm to the patient.
Okay. And we're also creating a PDA interface to make it easier for a doctor or for a researcher to change the settings with the PDA or to take readings or to upload a experimental file to the bandage.
Okay. To date, we've worked on determining what PDA we want to work with. That had some budget concerns, but we chose one that had an IR link, obviously needed for the project, and also in color so that it can be kind of nice looking. not necessary, but nice. We decided that we want to work in the Code Warrior development platform for the Palm OS, though we haven't been able to get that yet because all the copies are currently sold out. Right, we discussed that, and it's kind of been decided that we want to have a copy of it with this project because it's going to be an ongoing development, so they may need to make changes to it, so they want to have that available for sure.
I can sell you mine, it'll work.
We'll have to look at the budget for that.
Okay.
We've also been doing some research into how IRDA specs work, just so we know the capabilities of the communication, what kind of packets you can send, if there's like link timeout or acknowledgments built in. We've had some reports that even though it does have acknowledgments built into the protocol, it does help to have another acknowledgement packet sent back. Though the explanation as to why that is wasn't in our research, but we'll certainly do some tests to make sure that that's the case. And we've also gone into the protocol design, which is basically we're going to be sending a command with the address of what variable we're trying to locate. And for a write command, we send the data. And for a read command, there is no data, but we expect to get that back. And the acknowledgement is basically an echo of our command, and on a read command, it'll also contain the data. For the interface, so far, we've defined a data file structure, and this is to interface with another student who's working on the PC application of this project, which is a database that houses the data from all these bandages permanently. Our aspect is more of to allow communication between the PC and the bandage, so it's an intermediary. And we've also recently done a simple Hello World type program as kind of on a development platform that's free on the web, just so we know that we can program and that we've got the tools to go ahead and move forward with that. We're pretty much on top of what we anticipated doing, except for a little bit behind on the development research on the PDA. That's kind of held up because we're not sure if we're going to be able to get Code Warrior or if we're going to have to go fully with the freeware. So we weren't sure where to focus our efforts yet at this time. But other than that, we're on task. We're both going to be pretty much splitting duty on all these tasks since it's just a two-man team. Thought it would be easier to just kind of both have the full understanding of what's going on. Questions?
How much are you willing to pay for Code Warrior?
Up to $25.
Oh, I can do better on eBay.
All right.
Okay. Is it the current edition? You know,
I think it is the current edition. Okay. Actually, there's not that much difference between them.
They're both sold out, though.
But I do have my version. Okay.
Can you give us an estimate as to what you think you'd be willing to part with it for?
No, probably 100. But for you guys, 150. It's his mic. Okay. Let's see. Questions back there? Anyone else doing PDA software development? No one?
We're doing cell phone.
What?
We're doing cell phone development.
Would you like to use it?
Well, cell phones and another project coming up. Different applications. Are you going to investigate the possible causes of dropouts in the physical link? Because as I pointed out in your proposal evaluation, you know, one of the big problems with the IR link, and if you've played with an IR link between PDA and a laptop, you notice it's real, it seems to be very sensitive to both angle more so than even just distance. So I can imagine Gottner holding it like this, okay, or, you know, is your protocol going to be able to handle shake?
Yeah, well, that's going to be one of the most important parts of our protocol is making sure it's able to reconnect and, like, bring it back up to speed. I mean, we'll look into how much the angle affects the disconnecting it and see if we can't improve
now,
it.
Does this imply that you're going to have to go beyond a simple protocol which would just acknowledge and, for example, do checksumming and stuff of all the data?
The checksum's built into the IRDA
protocol
itself. So as long as the packets arrive at their destination, the IRDA protocol guarantees that the data integrity.
And are you going to be transmitting a lot of information or just a little bit?
It's
pretty
minor, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, do these bandages already have electrical, or are you going to be creating a receiver also?
The bandages are what Dan Howe's been working on, and they do have the IRDA equipment built into them. He doesn't actually have bandages yet, but he's got the board that's going to be running them built, so we'll be interfacing with that.
What's the mode of delivering the bandages for these signals, electrical pulses?
We can't talk about that.
we don't know. That's out of our own.
Okay. Any
other
questions? That would indicate some power requirements.
For the bandage itself, they're designed to run for about a week and then be discarded. I don't know what it's running off of, though.
Yeah, you might want to put a reference in your interim report or something to where you can find out more information about it or whatever. You know, maybe it's the in-house thesis or something.
We're also not sure how much we're allowed to divulge.
Yeah,
because it's a research project and they don't want spilling out, so we'd have to investigate that.
Well, I don't know. As a taxpayer, it's funded by NIH and is in the public domain.
Plus academic setting.
Yes, plus an academic setting, but talk to your advisor about that. I'm sure we'll go out and tell Johnson & Johnson. Hear that, everyone? We'll talk about that when it gets to the ethics component, of course. Okay, very good. Cryogenic motor, folks. And let's see who our next. That ought to be a good number. Okay, I was so quick for the wireless gun target, folks. So you'll be next.
Sorry about that.
On red. Right click doesn't.
Right
click.
Another
one's going any thick.
There you go.
Did anything happen? No.
Try getting pulling control while you pull.
I'm
email it to you.
What's the hot? There it is.
Page open, page up.
All
right.
Strange technical problem.
Definitely.
The title of our project is Low Power Motor for Use in Cryogenic Vacuum. The date is Monday's date. I didn't notice that. My name is David Buckmaster. My partner is Richard Manfredi. Our technical advisor is Wyatt Newman, and our sponsor in the physics department, the one that came up with the project, is John Rule. Little background on the physics department project to begin with. They're conducting experiments to measure cosmic microwave background radiation. And to do that, they're going to take some optical equipment, put it on a balloon at the South Pole, and leave it up there for a couple days spinning at about 10 to 20 hertz. And from that, somehow, they're going to get data. Our project is to design a motor that's going to spin their optical equipment. So the requirements that that situation places on us is that the motor has to operate in a cryogenic environment. We're anticipating a temperature of about 4 Kelvin. Has to rotate at a near constant 10 to 20 hertz with very, very low fluctuations, both in high frequency and low frequency components of the average rate of rotation. Needs to consume very low amounts of power. The specification that we were given is kind of preliminary. Basically, John was kind of guessing, but he said that he would like us to stay below 10 milliwatts in the steady state. And a really low magnetic field is required because a magnetic field being generated by the motor would interfere with the equipment. So, again, the requirement is pretty preliminary, but he said that he wants the magnetic field generated by the motor at a distance of a meter from the motor to be lower than the magnitude of the Earth's magnetic field. So, the different phases...
How
do you
do that?
Well, I can get into that. So we divided the project into separate phases. The first phase is to test candidate materials for the electromagnets that are going to drive the motor itself. The next phase is going to be testing a prototype motor. And the final phase, our main deliverable of the project, is going to be to produce a paper design of a preliminary motor that's specifically designed for this. Under material testing, we're researching to get a list of candidate materials, and we're going to wrap a coil around them, pass current through the coil, and see what kind of power losses the material causes at a cryogenic temperature. This is all using equipment that's in the physics lab. John has basically explained to us how to work all that, and he's going to supervise us for the first couple times. Motor testing, our prototype motor is going to incorporate materials that we tested at the cryogenic temperatures, and we're going to try and get power loss readings at room temperature and eventually estimate what they would be in the cryogenic temperature, because that to expect a cryogenic test with a full motor is a little bit extreme for a semester. And the motor design, again, is just going to be a paper design. Still prototype. They plan to work on this for a lot longer, so another group is going to be able to take it up and work on it. What accomplishments to date? Our literature search has yielded some results. We've almost entirely completed our research on both candidate materials and motors that have already been designed for this application. We initially were going to look into bearing performance at cryogenic temperatures, but it was decided to keep the focus of the project on the motor itself and go with a basic needle bearing, which is basically just a plate spinning on a needle. Our material testing, like I said, Professor Rule has explained to us how it works. We have access to his lab. We're expecting our candidate materials to be in hand early next week, and we're almost ready to conduct the first test where we get a feel for how things work and the procedure that we're going to have to follow. In the motor phase of the project, we've decided on a variable reluctance magnetically stabilized motor. Basically, this diagram is a kind of crude outline of what a variable reluctance motor is. These would be the cores of the electromagnets, and this is the coil that wraps around it. You have the different electromagnets have current waveforms that are out of phase with each other, and depending on how many phases you want, that's how many different current waveforms you have to have. As this spins around and the currents in this one drop and the current in this one picks up, it'll pull the motor towards it, and that's what a variable reluctance motor does. You just vary current waveforms depending on how many phases you want. This is a two-phase motor. Ours is going to be three to kind of add to the smoothness of the motion, because, like I said, they want very low frequency variations in the rotation. Our basic design of the motor parts is almost complete. Rich has a lot of experience with machining and CAD design, and he has basic drawings of all the parts that we're going to machine, and he has access to a lab where those things can be done. So our project management plan, you can't really see it because it got so small, but this is what the current date is. Again, material research is not completed. We have a couple more days to finish that. Our design test has been held up a little bit because of the parts that were ordered and just arrived. We're anticipating having the apparatus for testing completely assembled by Monday. The baseline test hasn't been started because it's dependent on the design test and apparatus phase, but the baseline test, it was allotted that two-week period mainly as a window and not because it's going to actually take that long, so it's really nothing to be concerned about. Acquire and order materials, we allotted about 3 weeks to order and wait for parts, and some things have been ordered, some things haven't, and we're waiting. Our research on existing motors has yielded some things. We're going to take a couple more days and keep looking to see if we can find anything more applicable, but if we had to stop right now, we would have gotten enough information to go off of. Design motor electronics is a little bit behind because of the complications that come out of deciding what kind of motor you're actually going to use. But you can see we've kind of made up some of the time that we're behind on the design and fabricate the parts because our CAD drawings have already been started. And that's basically everything that we were supposed to have started by now.
So yes. First of all, what you just explained now makes very understandable of what you really intended to do when you wrote down your proposal. Mm-hmm. What you're really doing is designing a motor and testing it at room conditions and extrapolating the results,
right,
as opposed to testing cryogenically. Is that right?
Well, correct. We're also going to use bearing originally, too.
Yeah. Well, the bearing initially wasn't our main focus. We couldn't completely rule it out because to design a motor without any sort of bearing to transfer the motion is...
Right. Wouldn't do much.
Yeah. So, but,
are you worried at all about shielding?
We don't know yet. It's basically that's the result that we hope to get from the cryogenic test of a core material and a coil is how much, like, power is going to be escaping from the actual electromagnet through hysteresis losses in the material and any current losses in the field and all that. So we don't know whether it's going to cause a problem, but our feeling for it is that since we're only looking to drive this disc at 10 to 20 hertz, and they're only worried about conditions in the steady state, the current, we should be able to drop the current so low that there shouldn't be much of a problem. So like I said, that's something that we're going to see later.
Well, you've got an approach anyway. Okay.
Okay. Actually, I do have one question. When did you decide that it would be variable reluctance, or was that sort of a given from day one?
That was something that Professor Newman kind of pushed us towards. I think he had it in mind from the beginning.
Okay. That was never clear when you were going to pick a particular type of motor.
Yeah, Professor Newman in our first group meeting, when we all met with Professor Newman, John Rule, and the both of us, when we got together, he pretty much pushed us forward, and he was like, this is going to be the easiest design for you guys to do. It's probably going to have the least complications, and it's probably going to work most efficiently at these low temperatures. And since he has motor design experience, we figured we'll listen to the professional and go in that direction.
So. Okay. Let's see.
in your reports and stuff, you probably should be careful about using the word superconducting, since the impression I have now is this is not a superconducting motor.
Well,
or a general motor.
It's a cryogenic motor that we're going to use superconducting wire to wrap the coils with. So we'll be able to, we'll pretty much drop all I squared R losses out the window and just have to concentrate on our eddy current and on our other losses. And so that way, that pretty much just leaves us with, by making that assumption, we're dropping out most of our problems as far as losses goes.
I mean, any mention to superconducting is specifically the wire that we're wrapping the magnet.
Okay. By the way, would you like to have a department seminar on how to design a superconducting motor? Not yet. I can bring someone in to do it. We have
that
a group
would be
in town that's been doing this research for almost 20 years, and they now have a, I think it's a 10,000 horsepower superconducting motor for nuclear submarines.
That could be fun to build.
Bigger than yours,
yeah.
But, if you want to get in touch with them, I can put you in touch.
Yeah. That does sound be good.
Yeah. They're at Rockwell.
Okay.
Okay. But they do cryogenic motor design.
We actually found something that's almost exactly what we're doing at NASA Glenn, but their motor is supposed to rotate at about 20,000 RPM, and we're looking for...
Okay, just slow it down. Okay, excellent. Okay, questions?
So how do you intend to minimize the torque ripple? Are you going to try to optimize the geometry, or are you going to do it by a special controller?
Like I said, the motor is going to be a three-phase motor, so that in itself kind of reduces that over a two-phase motor. But things that we can do to minimize that include warping the current waveform to decrease the jerking around or whatever, and also shaping the poles that are going to come down over the plate itself, the electromagnetic poles that come down over the plate. Shaping it can kind of direct the field, and if it's too sharp, we can broaden the field and have a slower transition from low to high. So, yeah.
I'm just clarifying that this is direct driving that's turning. It's not, there's no transmission in between.
Correct.
Otherwise, you'd have to have a cryogenic transmission, which would be another project.
Yeah, that'd be at least another semester.
But if you've got thoughts on that, I bet Newman would like to talk to you. It's rather a cool subject. Hey, I can get away with this. Okay, very good. Okay, on target.
Since it's not letting us save, do you want me to just email it to you?
Yeah, just email it to me.
Sharp. Yep.
Network controlling, Dean Spearing. You guys will be next.
There's an updated.
Yeah,
this is updated. Yeah, we come.
Oh, you already got it?
Yeah.
Oh, we're good.
Sweet.
Good to go.
So is this one?
Real close.
Did you get the update? That I guess Dan had a 468 score.
Yes. Thank the Lord. Yeah.
Okay. We're excited.
We're excited that we can get a scope to work with.
Yeah.
Mark that up on the list.
Okay, so go ahead.
All right. My name is David Simpson. I'm here with Bill Wieman and Ryan Kaufman, who are both we're all electrical engineers. Other team member is Eric Litvek, who is a computer engineer. And we're working on the automatic gun target actuation system. Our technical advisor is Mark Padani, who works for PGN Diversified Industries. So basically right now, in a lot of large gun clubs and military shooting ranges, there are many different types of gun target systems. And right now there is one that sits on the floor that can actuate a target from the horizontal to the vertical, detect bullet strikes, and actuate it back down to the horizontal. Right now, the problem with that design is that they have limited flexibility and they are extremely high in cost. usually the actuator unit, requires an extremely bulky control unit, bulky as in the size of maybe two large filing cabinets, and it requires a wired AC source as well on the field. So our goal is to design and build a portable targeting system, basically the same system that can be programmed by a laptop, and perform the other operations, actuation, and everything else, and cost under $500. So, once again, the specifications for our unit that it can reliably detect a bullet hit on a Coroplast target, which is a industry standard for gun target silhouettes. It'll be able to actuate one of these gun targets in under 2 seconds, then back to the horizontal after a hit. And finally, the system will be able to will be powered by a fixed power supply, a 12-volt power supply, like a car battery. Now, Bill's going to take over for the status update and our project management.
Basically, what we've done so far, we've got two main developments that we're working on. One is detecting the bullet hit, which our plan is to do with an accelerometer. It's basically a small chip. We have a development board from Freescale Semiconductor, which will hopefully give us a signal once the target is hit. And that testing was scheduled earlier. It's been moved, and I'll talk about that more in the next slide. What we've done at this point is mostly build a prototype actuator, which is a very rough estimate of what we want to do in the end. We've basically got a frame and a bar that will rotate the target from horizontal to vertical. Currently, it's not controlled by the microprocessor, but it will be eventually. We've tested the accelerometer in the lab to make sure we get a good signal, and hopefully when the target gets hit by a bullet, we'll still get a good signal. And we've also kind of worked on our budget goals to know what kind of price we're looking for. We have the accelerometer, but what kind of price we'd look for in the event of actually manufacturing, say, 10 of these for a target range. For our management plan, we're pretty much on schedule. The actuator structure is just about right. Sample targets have been made from the Coroplast. We're a bit behind on the motor controls, but that's really not an issue because we've figured out what motors we're using and we'll be moving forward with that quickly here. The lab testing is finished, which was making sure the accelerometer gives us good output. So we're ready to go to put that on the target and do a range test with it. Our actual field data test got postponed. We were planning to do it last Friday, but we had some difficulty finding an oscilloscope so we could see what our waveform, what our output was from the accelerometer. So that's now been rescheduled for this Friday since we've found an oscilloscope now and we'll be able to go do that. After that test, we'll be looking at our data to see if the accelerometer is adequate or if we need to investigate other sensors or look at, you know, other alternatives, maybe pairing the accelerometer with a microphone or something like that so that we could get a confirmed hit. And that's pretty much all. Yeah. Any questions?
How small do you think your final unit's going to be? You didn't mention the physical size of your unit, but you did say the other one is the size of two large filing cabinets.
Well, we're going to be foregoing that whole control unit since we're going to be powering our unit, since we'll be configuring our unit with the laptop. So our actuator unit will probably be about the same size, roughly yay long.
Use engineering terms.
Well, the physical dimensions of the target will be the same, but our control electronics will likely be a lot smaller. I mean, for a prototype, we've got a development board for the microprocessor, which is like 5 inches by 4 inches or something like that. And the accelerometer board is maybe an inch and a half by an inch.
Okay.
To be able to put it behind the target.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how large battery do you think we'll need?
Probably
a standard automotive battery.
Yeah, right now we're planning on like a car battery or smaller. kind of looking for
so
a global
to be able to survive for a while in the field. Mark wants it to be able to go up to like 100 times.
Yeah, I think our spec is like 500 times, in, or well, maybe 100
no,
times
100
in a day.
Times.
Yeah. So over the course of a day. So.
So you're not worried about where on the target a bullet would hit. You're just worried about the fact that a hit has happened.
Right, yes. Right. That it hit somewhere on the target. Mm-hmm. Hopefully not the hardware.
That's right. You get extra points for hitting.
Yeah.
You're designing a system for a single target or for a full range of targets?
Our project is to get this working for one target, to make sure we can detect it on one. Possibly in the future, it would be controlled remotely from a laptop, and like a network of multiple targets would be the ideal goal in the end.
Are you capable of registering multiple hits in a row?
That's going to depend a lot on what we get from our field testing, depending on what the output is from our accelerometer. If the target, you know, sways back and forth a lot afterwards, there might be a delay between, you know, like if you fire an M16 in burst mode or something, we might not be able to catch all three of those. But that we'll have to wait and see to see how much of a delay we need.
Current specs, though, for our project is to detect a single hit and in some fashion, like actuate real quick to verify that a target has been hit.
Are you having any issues with hardware protection, actually protecting all the electronics and whatnot, especially shooting and killing at your privates?
It shouldn't be too difficult because, I mean, in general, you've got the target and it's behind, say, like some kind of structure, either like concrete or sandbags or something to protect, you know, the lower portion of it. So our accelerometer won't be mounted high up on the target or anything like that. The goal is to keep it low and behind something that will, you know, protect it from people like us shooting at it.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Very good. Let's see. Beam steering. Network control.
That's smart.
Intense. Cell phone medical monitoring. You'll be next.
Alrighty. Excuse me while I whip this out. Oh, that's the easiest way of grabbing this thing.
I think it's a strong enough to have a label.
It's pretty strong. It's green though.
It's green though.
It's going to be hard to detect.
Well, I mean, at least it's better than blue.
Alright, what the hell is it? Alright, why does Internet Explorer suck?
Uh oh, same thing.
Where's Firefox?
Wait, we need the last time.
There is none. Alright. Well, I just clicked on it.
Just a block up.
Control and then open. That's the only way I can get it.
And open.
Alright. What the hell's wrong with this deal?
Open. Yeah.
Alright. How do I get this thing into projection? I hate Windows. God, do I hate Windows. All right.
No commercial endorsements.
Unix. It's not commercial. It's a standard. All right. Well,
okay.
All right. We are the 2D beam steering for network control. I'm Chad Greenbaum.
And I'm Dan Furst.
I'm Marco.
Our advisor and sponsor is Professor Liberatore. All right. Well, basically, the goal of our project is to keep a laser on a sensor over a large distance with both the target and laser moving. So if you'll see by the nice graphic, laser starts out at Glennon and hits a sensor over at Crawford, which is about 500 yards away. Doing all of this through the CASE network. CASE network does not exactly have a fixed delay to it, making closed-loop control very hard. It also requires moving the laser beam around.
back on this project calls for plus or minus 5 degrees. At this range, it's about 50 feet left or right. Basically, project involves two-dimensional beam steering, image processing for our sensor, which will be a cheap webcam, and closed-loop feedback over a wide area network. Currently, to date, we have research methods for doing the actual beam steering. Originally, this project called for using a micromirror, which is electronically controlled by MEMS. However, the mirror may or may not get here by mid-semester, making it unreliable to design for. So we will have to design our own prototype to stand in for a prototype. Basically, we have come up with two methods of doing the beam steering. One is to use a XY galvanometer scanner, which involves using two motors, or basically coils, that will rotate two individual mirrors up and down, causing the beam to deflect. Another method that we have found was devised by a guy in France, which is a cheaper version of this, which uses two speakers to use the up and down motion of the speakers to cause, and you can't really see it here, but the mirrors to sort of deflect back and forth. Our future work will be to design and build the mirror system, design and build the scanner prototype, whichever one we choose, design a controller for the scanner to actually physically allow us to control the position of the beam using output from a computer.